Are you an investor or entrepreneur wanting to raise capital? Well, put away those blues. It's time to the Private Investing and Business Hour, right here on OC Talk Radio, brought to you by CalCap. Their team includes over 24 venture partners that provide specialty skills in nearly all aspects of private company investing and financing. So let's welcome our host for these discussions. It takes us in and gives us the inside information, an inside look at what investors are looking for. Venture funds, angel investors, private investors, and all the others looking to invest in startup technologies today here. Let's bring him on board. Time for our host, Jim Butts. Hey, Jim.
Why, thank you, Paul. I'm here this afternoon with Ross Epstein. Ross is a venture partner with California Capital Partners, but he's also a lawyer. I've known Ross for probably about 10 years, maybe even a little bit longer. And Ross, why don't you take a couple minutes and introduce yourself and tell the audience who you are, where you're at, what you do, and you know what your focus is.
Okay, thanks, Jim. I appreciate you having me on the show. So I am an attorney. I describe myself as intellectual property and business attorney. And the firm I'm with is called Tech Law, and it is an intellectual property and business boutique law firm. It's 15 attorneys that do patents and trademarks and copyright work, as well as transactional work, which is usually IP or technology related, but not always. We also have a general corporate transactional practice, which is usually intellectual property or technology related. But can also involve mergers and acquisitions, capital raising, employee incentives, sort of a garden variety of corporate work that also, and also we wind up sometimes playing an outsourced general counsel role for a number of our clients. Personally, I've had a relatively unusual career as an attorney. I started out as a litigator with a big law firm in a traditional way. But then took my first left turn and moved to Eastern Europe, where I was an entrepreneur in the telecom industry for what turned out to be a 9-year adventure, and then came back to San Diego after exiting from that business, and that's when I got back into law and into this type of practice with intellectual property and business.
So one of the things that I hear, maybe you could give some clarity to, every so often I hear this term boutique. What does it mean when you say that you're a boutique law firm?
What it usually means is that you specialize in an area of law and stay focused on that area of law. Mm. So in our case, it's intellectual property. So the focus of the firm, of the 15 attorneys, 10 of them are patent attorneys. The other 5 are trademark specialists and transactional attorneys. And even one of the guys who's up in Orange County, who's a corporate transactional attorney, his focus is technology-based businesses. So all of his clients are technology-based businesses, mm-hmm. which winds up fitting well with the focus of the firm, which is intellectual property.
Mm-hmm. When you're thinking about, because you're talking about tech firms, you're talking about the intellectual property piece of it, who do you find is kind of like your perfect client?
A perfect client for us is usually a well-established company that's technology-based, mm-hmm. and that technology can be anything from therapeutics in the biotech industry, medical devices, telecom, internet software, but they don't have in-house counsel. They're not large enough or have the volume of work that would substantiate or that would make an in-house counsel person make sense for them. Mm-hmm. So we play that role. We wind up becoming their IP counsel or their general counsel, and that way we get insight into what's happening in the business and can capitalize on our expertise in our areas of expertise.
So if they're well established, then I'm making some assumptions now, which I've been known to be wrong, so I'm okay if I'm wrong. If they're well established, then if they're, let's say, in the biotech or the medical device space, are you running into people that already have patents and intellectual property that are trying to do something else, or they're starting from scratch? And that didn't make sense. If they've been well established, they probably are, a lot of what they've done is at risk then, right? If they haven't got anything covered.
Right, and that's a great point. I mean, usually our opportunity comes up when that well-established company is unhappy for one reason or another with their current counsel. Okay. And so if it's well-established, that means they usually have 50 to 100 people. They've got a portfolio, intellectual property portfolio. They're either pretty far along in the development and commercialization process of their technology, and they're looking for a company or a firm to work with going forward that is reasonably priced but can deliver high quality. And a lot of times what we wind up doing is taking over from larger firms that, you know, they're not institutional enough to fit a large firm, so the pricing is not quite right or the staffing is not quite right, and they're feeling they're not quite getting the value for money that they're looking for.
So could you give a couple examples of things that companies are really not happy about that seem to be maybe even consistent problems that you see when you're called in?
Yeah, probably the number one thing that companies aren't happy about with their attorneys is their lack of responsiveness. You know, they'll put a call in or send an email, and it will be days before, maybe even a week before they hear back. And I think there's nothing that pisses off a client more than having a service provider who isn't responsive. You know, and that's even more important to them, I think, than the price. Mm-hmm. And then price is probably the second most important thing. And I think there are internal dynamics inside large firms that create much more cost than there needs to be to deliver the same quality or better quality. And that's just another thing that really gets clients upset.
You know, what's interesting is when you answer that, I would think that it's something that somebody, I would have thought that the answer would have been something that somebody should have known about, that they should have told them about, that all of a sudden they're finding out that they've got the wrong, they've marked the wrong thing or the patent wasn't broad enough. But in fact, you brought up things that had nothing to do with the law itself. It was really about how you deliver customer service.
And I think you're right. I think that most lawyers, frankly, are pretty good at what they do. I mean, technically. You know, I think that there are quite a lot of talented lawyers out there. But they're in situations where the dynamics of their particular firm create a need to behave a certain way or a situation where they can't avoid behaving a certain way. And really, that's what upsets clients. I think the quality of the work can be suspect. And if somebody does screw up, and that does happen too, you know, I think the biggest challenge on the quality from larger firms, at least, is that if it's not an institutional client, the most experienced person doesn't actually do the work. They push it down to a less experienced person who's still pretty expensive, who doesn't have the experience, could be very bright, but then doesn't get the necessary review of the work or the training that they need, and suddenly the client then does have a quality issue, but still pays quite a lot for that. So quality does come into play, but I think the first two things are the things you hear most clients complain about.
Is there anything you're hearing about that's evolving right now that's going to either you know is becoming an issue or you think is going to become an issue in the next 6 to 12 months?
An issue in what regard?
In terms of intellectual property or what's happening in terms of patents or patent law or things somebody should consider?
Right, that's a great question. I think the most recent series of decisions by the Supreme Court, and by the way, one of the interesting phenomenons of the last 5 years or so in the intellectual property space was the complaints about the patent system and about how the quality was not good and how there were too many people enforcing a series of poor patents,
right.
And there was a movement to change the patent scheme dramatically. And what they got was a change in the patent scheme, which was not quite as dramatic, and the Supreme Court actually stepped up and made a series of decisions to address some of these issues to try to improve some of the quality of the patents that were coming out. And there still are some more specific issues that have come out recently. There was a case which is now known as the Alice case, which addressed software patents, which are obviously pretty important for a lot of companies, especially on the high-tech side of the technology aisle. And right now, it's not clear where that's going to go and how easy or difficult it will be to obtain a software patent going forward. Most people are not that concerned about most people who know what's going on are concerned about it, but not to the point where they don't think it's going to be allowed anymore. It's just going to have to be carefully crafted, which again helps improve the quality ultimately of what's getting issued at the patent office.
Yeah, I was surprised that there were a number of even well-known investors that were against software patents because they believe that once something becomes patented, then no one else can effectively use it in the same way. And they were saying that it was stifling innovation.
Well, that is the engineer's complaint about patents. And there's a collaborative aspect and proprietary nature of of engineering where people really like to work together and don't want to be limited. It's also been true in the copyright, in what's known as the copyleft movement, and the general license that has been there as part of open source, right? The whole idea was we don't want people to have copyrights because copyrights limit collaboration and innovation. And that's, I don't know if that's true. There's certainly an argument that's been made, but I think also if you don't have intellectual property rights, it becomes a question of service, a service business with no real upside. You know, intellectual property rights create value that otherwise wouldn't exist.
Yeah, I actually don't understand how things like pharma or medical device or, you know, all the stuff being done in healthcare could actually exist without patents. I mean, that's the value. That's where all the value is in these companies.
Yeah, I mean, the real competing thing has been over the years the antitrust concept, right? The idea that one company, if they're really good at patenting, can corner the market, which then impacts competition in a really negative way, which is what the antitrust laws are about.
Right.
And it's always been kind of a balance between antitrust and patenting, you know, from a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the smaller scale with copyrights and software patents, it's more of a preference of engineers in particular to want to collaborate without restraint. And their feeling is patents and copyrights and other intellectual property rights interferes with that freedom to collaborate, which is not necessarily true. I mean, it's true to a certain extent, but not to the point where I think a lot of people take it.
Well, yeah, and when you look at things like pharma, I mean, first of all, 10 of the 17 years of patent is involved in getting through the FDA process for a lot of these things. And it costs a fortune to get through that. And you know, if you're not able to have something you can hold on to that at least try to be able to make some of the money back that you've invested, and someone else is going to sit on the sidelines and look at what you're doing and reverse engineer it and come out with a product, not having to do all that investment to go through the first 10 years and be able to take advantage of that without you having any protection, I mean, what's the point of trying to develop anything?
Exactly. I mean, the whole idea behind the patenting scheme is to give the patent owner a mini monopoly for a limited period of time. But the scheme is also designed to get great inventions out into the public domain so that genetics companies can do their thing and make the drugs cheaper and more available.
Mm-hmm.
And that other things that are great inventions are not proprietary forever, that do get into the public domain so that they can become less expensive and available. But at the same time, the inventor deserves to be able to capitalize on their invention for at least a limited period of time, and that's really how the whole thing is invented. I mean, it's created. I mean, it actually costs, from a maintenance standpoint, like there are maintenance fees you pay during the lifetime of a patent.
Mm-hmm.
And the longer it's issued and is out there, the more expensive the maintenance fees become because they're trying to get people to give up the rights and let that great invention be available to the general public.
Yeah, I think that there's a bigger risk to the whole pharma industry when testing is going to be able to come out and determine whether, I mean, I remember reading about Lipitor, which was one of the most highly prescribed drugs, and how the vast number of people who take it won't ever be helped by the drug. And there are some tests that can be done to be able to identify whether or not somebody would benefit from it. And of course, if those kind of things become prevalent, all of a sudden, you're going to have to develop the same kind of a drug with a much smaller universe of people to sell it to. So what's going to happen to the cost of the medication when it comes out? It's going to be $100,000 a pill. I think that that's a bigger risk to the people than what's happening in terms of patents. Without naming kind of the companies you're working for, what are some of the more interesting things that you've been working on in the last year?
Well, some of it's been some of it's fun because sometimes you have clients that have similar interests, and some are just sort of really fun because they're successful, right? So one of the funner ones is a client of mine that is now developing some really interesting gaming technology, and helping him in the brainstorming sessions on how to create the story that they're going to be using as the gaming is going on is really fun, and watching this person who was actually in operations for a biotech company now as an entrepreneur, and the things that he's pursuing has also been really fun. So there's nothing more gratifying for me than watching my clients succeed, getting their businesses funded, having exits, putting things together that are successful. That's really, really good stuff.
So is this somebody that's actually working on in a real game, or is somebody who's working on gamification that could be used in a lot of different areas?
It's actually it's kind of both. It's okay. It is a real game, and okay. It is going to be primarily mobile. That's the goal,
of course.
But the strategy is really interesting. I don't want to talk about it too much
because I'm
careful about the confidentiality aspects of it. But he's got a really concrete strategy on how he's going to do this from the creative side as well as from the business side. It's just really fun to work with people that are smart and entrepreneurial. And I think that he appreciates my particular take because, again, since I've been an entrepreneur, right. It gives me, probably a little bit different perspective than other attorneys who have never been in the trenches running a business and having to deal with all those day-to-day issues. And at the same time, try and have a vision for where you want to take your business and then try and execute on that vision, which is what every entrepreneur tries to do. And having done all that to some degree of success, it's great to see other people doing it and try to help them along to make them successful.
Yeah, anybody that's doing anything in gaming today, unless you really are just psychotic, you got to be looking at it to be mobile, because the last number I saw, there's 5 billion smartphones, and in the next couple of years, there's going to be more smartphones than there are people. So I don't know who's buying all these things, but the numbers are just ridiculous. And millennials don't use anything but smartphones. So I think they check their smartphones like 300 times a day. So there's a whole demographic that if you're going to deal with them in any way, shape, or form, make sure that you can get it to them through some sort of a smartphone. That's interesting. Go ahead.
I agree with you. I agree 100%. That is the way it's going. And in fact, it's had some unexpected consequences for some old industries that are getting really killed by it.
Oh, yeah.
One example of that would be the direct response industry. Mm-hmm. The people that make infomercials, right? Mm-hmm. The paradigm was you could have a half-an-hour infomercial, basically a half-hour TV show that people would actually watch and then maybe buy whatever it was you were selling on that
right.
show.
Right.
But now, because the screens have become so fragmented, people don't watch TV the way they used to.
Right.
So they don't have the patience. They're looking at their phones, they're watching on their computers, you know, they're streaming, they're not necessarily watching cable or other network TV. So it's really had a major impact on that industry, which used to just pump out billion-dollar products on a regular basis.
Right. Yeah, actually, I won't talk too much about the company, but we recently talked to a company that we're looking to potentially take on. And they actually have a technology that would allow you to, they could insert their program in the middle of a stream. And as you're watching it, if you decided, do you want to know the price of something, you could just click on it and it would come up and tell you what the price was, even if it was embedded in the show itself. So you didn't have to have a commercial. You could be watching something and say, oh, that's a really nice phone. What is that? Can you click on it and get some information about it and then potentially buy it? When I talked to them, they were talking about their competition and they didn't mention Sony. And I said, I'd seen some stuff that Sony had done many years ago. And they said, we know about them. They know about us. But this is one of those things that there's a solution to that problem, that somebody has software that they could embed in, and as you're watching something on TV, you could start buying stuff. I mean, this is like getting crazy. Anything else you ran into that you found interesting?
Yeah, I think that there are some interesting solutions to problems that a lot of people don't appreciate exist, right? So, one example is a company that, or the shipping of produce. Right, for all the restaurants, is something that's been going on forever. But the idea of being able to really track what's happening inside the delivery truck, right, has been a challenge. I mean, literally, the old technology until the very recent past was, you might have sensors in there, but they aren't real, they aren't very accurate, and they're not really being used the way that they might be. Right. So literally, you have a head of lettuce and see whether it's still okay to use, just stick a thermometer in the middle of it and take its temperature. And that's literally been what people have been doing. So a client of mine came up with a solution. First of all, first as a product to put into the delivery trucks that would mimic the produce, which makes perfect sense. And then as the ambient temperature changes as you open and close the delivery truck as you're making your deliveries, mm-hmm. you know exactly what's happening to the produce. So you then don't have the error. People would err on the side of being very careful because you have to be, and then get rid of a huge amount of what would otherwise be potentially usable produce. Now the efficiencies are dramatically better, and he's gone from the hard this hardware type product to a software as a service where now the sensors are accurate and he's really doing well making that happen. So it's that's very, very cool.
I actually had not heard of those kind of things. I mean, I think that they're great. I hadn't heard of them, but that's the kind of thing that can also change. I don't know what, I'm trying to remember what show it was on. Somebody put a reality show on in the last couple of weeks where a couple was going to live for 30 days on stuff that they picked out of the trash. And they were going to things like supermarkets and finding out what supermarkets were throwing away because they said that there was quality food that they just didn't know how to deal with, so they were just tossing it. So I know that that's a big problem if somebody's going to do a reality show on something like that. So for a company to come up with a solution, first of all, whoever's this getting rid of this stuff, they've got to eat the cost of it. So you're going to be able to reduce their costs, but also you'll be able to do better quality for the consumer. That's a very interesting. I'd be interested as you're going along with that to hear more about it. Very interesting aspect of it. Well, I want to tell you that we've been having a great conversation, but our time is just about up. So I want to give you an opportunity. If somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to be able to do that?
Well, either by email or telephone. I don't know. Can I give my email address?
Sure,
my phone?
Yeah, it's yours.
So I can be reached at Ross. R-O-S-S at techlawllp.com. That's techlawllp.com. Or our telephone number is 888-989-8529, and I'm extension 88. Our systems are often in the cloud, so that's one of our cloud technologies. It gets us a very efficient way of being able to be reached either by telephone or by internet.
Great. Well, it was really interesting. It was great to be able to catch up with you. And look forward to talking to you some more in the future.
Thanks, Jim. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, too.
Bye now.
All right, before we come back, let's do a quick shout-out to our sponsors of today's program, CalCap Partners. California Capital Partners, LLC, is the manager of venture capital funds, specializing in investing in small to medium and technology-based businesses with high growth potential. As such, their team incorporates a variety of managers of previous investment transactions who collectively exceed US $2 billion with successful outcomes since the 1980s. That's a lot of money that they've been involved in raising. So they also have operations here in the US, both California and New York, and Canada, Ontario, and British Columbia specifically. They also bring together a global network of strategic resources consisting of managerial talent and capital resources that really add value to all their portfolio companies. They also have, and this is very intriguing for those, we did a show on this earlier, a proprietary investment process that enhances outcomes for both the investors and the portfolio companies. They call it SEAM, Sourcing, Evaluation, Investing, and Monitoring System. Sourcing, Evaluation, Investing, and monitoring the whole system. So if you want people with a proven track record and a long list of successful accomplishments in their own proprietary investment process, you've really only got one choice, CalCap Partners. Simply visit their website, just like it sounds, Cal, C-A-L, Cap, C-A-P, Partners, plural, .com. All right, back to Jim.
Well, thanks, Paul. And we're back from commercial, and we're going to continue the conversation I'm having with Mark Burton on M&A, mergers and acquisition, things to consider. So what do you want to talk about next, Mark?
I'm wide open, but we had an interesting conversation just a little while back about how an acquisition must fall into a company's overall strategic plan.
Right.
And I think that's something that your audience really needs to be thinking about. All too often, I know you've seen it, I've seen it, where a company will snap up another company, almost like an impulse buy. Even though this is a time-consuming process, it's almost an impulse buy. They see the EBITDA, they see the revenue, this is something they like, and they jump at it.
Right.
And what they haven't done is they haven't looked at their strategic plan, whether it's a 1-year, 18-month, 3-year, 5-year, or whatever it is, and say, how does this fit in? Yeah. Am I going to be changing my business too much? Is there a more advantageous acquisition for me? Or do I just hold, grow organically, and build capital for an even better or more valuable acquisition down the road?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah, especially when you start looking at things like revenue. So you look at the company you're acquiring's revenue. One of the things you absolutely have to understand is what was the operations that were required to generate that revenue? And can I, as the acquiring company, continue and vertically integrate them into my own operation? Because otherwise, one of the things that could happen, if you have to operate separately, what you end up doing is your costs end up being out of line because you got two disparate things you got to be able to bring together at some point and make the financials work. And that can cost you a lot of money. The company that AT&T acquired, by the way, I don't mention the company, but one of the things that I had found out when I had been doing some investigation of them, because I did strategy at the time, and I was looking strategically at this company, and one of the things I found out was they had acquired a company 2 years before. And when someone, this is when I first learned how to read an annual report, a 10K, and the woman that was teaching me, she said, look, this is they acquired this company. I said, well, what can you tell me about that? She said, let's go to the notes and to the financials. And we found that they spent an enormous amount of money on engineering that year. And then the next year's 10K, when we looked at it, they spent no money on engineering, and they spent a fortune on marketing. And it was really easy for us to conclude at that point that they spend the money trying to vertically integrate the acquired product line with their existing product line. They couldn't do it. So they decided to scrap that idea and come up with a marketing plan to see if they could fool people into saying it was an integrated product line, but it wasn't. I mean, you really have to know when you're doing this. And you know, if you're buying some company and you don't actually have a 3 or 5 year plan, how do you know what you're going to do? How do you know that this is going to fit with where you're going? We were actually trying very hard to make sure that we had a strategic plan that we were following, and if we were making a decision like that, it was based upon us really having talked it over a lot about whether or not this makes sense or not. So it's true.
I'm going to add one more thing to that. You know, in our 2 segments ago now, we discussed, if I want to get purchased, what do I have to do? And we had noted that one of the things that you should be thinking about is who are the strategic acquirers who would most likely grab me? Now, when you're looking at acquiring someone, you still need to have your exit strategy, particularly if it involves a strategic acquirer, in mind. Does your acquisition take you closer to, keep you on an even keel, or take you farther away from what would be attractive to your strategic acquirers? If you start going off into sidelines that are meaningless to them, if you're a network software company, and you start picking up, for God knows why, hardware companies, well, a larger network software company that's got no relationships in hardware and never has had an urge to go into the hardware business, you've just lost points with them because now they've got something, you've got a division now that they don't want, they're going to have to get rid of.
Yeah, you know, I think the other thing to look at, Mark, is if you're looking at the financials of the company you're thinking about acquiring, if you can actually get to see them at some point in time, then and you find out that 50% or more of the revenue comes from one company, be very careful.
Oh, God, yes. That's, you know, I actually take that a lot farther down than 50%. I say 15%.
Yeah.
10%, 15% comes from one company?
Yeah.
You're running into the danger zone.
Yeah, I only said the 50 because sometimes when you're dealing with much earlier stage companies and technologies, there could be some place where they've got a big customer. But certainly you have to understand and you have to ask yourself the question, regardless of what number, 10, 15 or 50%, if my acquiring that company got in the way of that customer wanting to stay with us, what would that do to two things? First of all, the results of the acquisition, would it make it negative versus positive? And two, would it really hurt the overall position of our company when those kind of revenues didn't come in again? Mm-hmm. Good.
Agreed.
Good. So one of the other things we wanted to talk about was what are the kind of steps that you should take in preparing to sell your company, and when would you start doing those?
Conventional wisdom says 3 years beforehand. My attitude is if you can begin to prepare your company 5 years beforehand, then that would be great. The steps are somewhat repetitive of the conversation we had 2 segments ago, but I want to go through those again a little bit. First off, get your financials into great shape and go spend the money for either, depending upon how much your revenues are, either at least a review or a full audit, and do it every year for those 3 to 5 years that we're looking at it. You want your financials to be bulletproof. Second, make sure that your operations are well documented into handbooks so that anybody can step in and take a look and see, here's all the processes, whether it's manufacturing, supply chain, marketing, administrative. Every single process you have should be documented in very, I mean, I hate to say it, assume that you're dealing with very stupid people and create the process that way. This can be a little bit pricey, but it's really important, and frankly, it's really critical for a business owner to do this at any time, because if something happens to him or her, you get in a ski accident and you're out of the office for 2 months, if you have all your processes down in a step-by-step manner, guess what? The business will keep running.
Yeah, let me just interject one thing in there. This is important not just if you think you're going to be acquired, but if you're in early stage, like let's say a tech company, and you believe that someplace in your future you're going to have a venture capital round, you better do this from the beginning. Because when a VC comes in to look at doing an investment, one of the things they're going to ask for is all the documentation. They want to make sure that you've got a personnel manual that's got everything sort of lockstep, that you've got all your agreements, all the things that you would look at if you were acquiring a company a VC looks at before they invest in it. Because they have a financial responsibility to the limited partners to make sure that everything's key. So either way, whether you think you're going to get acquired or you think you're going to go for investment, this is an important element for the management team to take care of.
Another one, legal. Now, here's one where private companies fall apart all the time. They forget to hold their annual shareholders meeting. They forget to have their board members meetings. Yeah. And along comes this acquisition, particularly if it's an institutional, if it's a private equity fund. If it is a very large company like AT&T who's going to acquire you, they want to see that you did everything legally, which means you've had your annual board of directors meeting, you've had your annual shareholders meeting, and even if it's only you and your two partners sitting around having a scotch, you really should use these to be constructive and productive. But even if it's just that, have your lawyer put together the documents on an annual basis and have that ready to go. Make sure that you have kept up with your entity requirements with the state, that you're regularly filing your annual report to the state. These are small things that everybody forgets. You know, you pay your $750 or your $1,000 or $10,000, whatever you owe the state franchise tax board based on your revenues. You pay them every year, and you don't forget that there's follow-up documentation that you're supposed to have in-house. It's critical that you have that side of the game, too.
And regardless of how difficult it gets, if you're having revenue problems, do not ever not pay your payroll taxes.
Oh, God, no.
Take you to jail for that. But I have seen some people that were stupid enough to say, well, I'll do this now, but I'm going to use it because I have it, but I know I'm going to get it back, and then they don't. And the next thing, the payroll taxes are due, and they should have been paid, and they weren't. There's been some ugly situations because of that.
You know what else is you have to be very, very careful of? And I always suggest going to an attorney to help draft this, an attorney and an HR professional, is your hours and breaks. There's six or seven different agencies in California that oversee this for your employees. And they don't always agree with one another, which just makes it more difficult. But if you've got a very experienced employment attorney, if you've got a very experienced HR person, they can help you navigate what is basically the worst labyrinth of employment rules in the country, which sits right here in California.
Yeah, I've seen some of those where, depending upon what kind of an employee you are, your management or non-management, the wage and hour board doesn't want you to work so many hours without a break. So, you know, technically, legally, they say you can't work through lunch and leave an hour early. Because it's mandated because of who you are. You have to have a 15-minute break here, and then you have to have at least a half hour to eat lunch. So it's like you can't work through lunch and leave early. A lot of people don't know that.
That's right. You can't. It's unfortunate, but the state has determined that you don't get to let your employees do what they want.
Yeah.
So you've got to insist employees not work through lunch. You've got to give them that 15-minute break, and you got to insist they take it.
Yes,
it's very easy to get burned in this area.
Yeah,
and it's very expensive.
You know, one of the things people don't consider is when it's happening, when this is occurring, everybody's friends, and that's all great. If something starts to go south, and somebody goes and talks to somebody, and the next thing you know, there's a case built up against it. And it doesn't matter that everybody was happy when it occurred. It's just that, you know, whatever you did, you might have been doing something that's against the law. And mm-hmm. you're going to end up paying for it, so you want to do that. One of the last questions that we had over here, and we got about half of our time left, tell us a little bit about what does due diligence look like in getting ready for an acquisition or a merger?
What an overarching question.
Mm,
all right. You know, there's a lot of different categories, and what the first thing you have to understand is that due diligence is a step-by-step process. So before you get very serious, when you're still in the courting stage, is when you're most likely going to sign a non-disclosure agreement, and you're going to see the basic financials. You're going to see the audits. You're going to see the tax returns. By the way, this is very important. You want to see both the tax returns and the financials, mm-hmm. because they're going to be structured a little bit differently. And if you've got a really experienced person, they can look at each of them and determine whether or not someone's playing with the books.
Right.
So financials are automatic, and you know, just to kind of give you a laundry list. What I want to see in financials, I want to see 3 years tax returns minimum. I want to see 3 years financials minimum. I want to see year-to-date, and I'd like to see projections if you have it.
Right.
Now, I'd like to see business plans. This is just me personally. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back and see business plans on a regular basis so that I can look to see what this company thought it was going to do and what it did do. And just because it didn't hit its goals doesn't mean I'm going to nuke the company. I just want to see how consistent were they at sticking to the plan or modifying it as necessary. How flexible is that management team? Then we really get into some of the real gold areas, as I say jokingly. I want to see all employment manuals. I want to see the last couple of years if you've updated them. I want to see those process manuals we were talking about. I want to see sexual harassment mm-hmm. guides if you have it in there. Anything else related to that. I want to see all of your legal documents. And what I'm probably going to do, if it's a fairly serious acquisition, I'm probably going to bring an accounting firm in. One of the things I'm going to ask them to do is do what's called testing. Mm-hmm. I want to test your purchase orders, and I want to test your accounts receivable. I want to see how solid those numbers really are. And if there's been, particularly, if there's been money left on the table, or that you have been paying your bills. So this is, and these folks tend to be very good at, I think it's very important because it lets you know what kind of condition the company has really been in at the micro level.
Mm. Well, you know, one of the things that you brought to my mind when you were talking about that is that when you're looking at past goals and then results, one of the things you can do is if you see that somebody in the past has been setting goals and achieving them every time, and then they present you with a 5-year pro forma, given those people being in charge, you can pretty much say that there's a high probability you're going to make those goals. If you find somebody who was making goals and they weren't making them at all, then that 5-year pro forma, I mean, what does it actually mean at that point in time? You haven't been able to do it before. What have you learned now over the last 90 days that's going to be able to help you to make these kind of, most of the time, I used to hate that we call them hockey sticks. Mm-hmm. You know, you start at the beginning of the year and everything's nice and flat. By the time mid-year comes, in order to make the goals that you said you do in January, you have to do so much more in December, in November, December, where most companies didn't do as well in terms of actual monies. So you had these hockey sticks. So it's a good way for you to be able to also understand the people that you're talking to when they put a plan, when they say they're going to do something, and they acted on it. How often did they make those goals?
100%. That leads to the next part of due diligence, sitting down with the management team and key personnel. And keep in mind, key personnel may not be part of the management team.
Right.
You know, if we're talking about a bakery, well, chances are they've got at least one baker in there whose job is to create new products
right. Or
improve upon the existing ones. Let's talk to that person. Let's make sure that person's still excited. Let's find out how that person operates. Does it work with whatever I'm doing? And I'm assuming this is a larger food company purchasing a bakery.
Okay.
But, you've got to get to know the key personnel. You've got to know the management team. And in a way, this is a two-way interview. as well it should be. Do you want to work with this individual? Mm. Are there a few enough people that you're going to toss where it's worth going after the company? Because at the end of the day, and you said this many times before, Jim, I've heard you, the most important asset a company has is its human capital.
Sure.
And so you want to make sure there's enough human capital that you want to work with to move forward. So that's absolutely critical. Another critical factor that I think people don't really pay attention to is the due diligence team you put together. And typically there's at least three outside professionals on that team. You're going to have a CPA who has experience in mergers and acquisitions. And I'm going to repeat this for each and every one of these. There's a lot of CPAs out there that are great in tax. There's CPAs out there that are great in what we call audit and assurance. But those are different practice groups that can play in. You can play in the due diligence sector. But you really want a CPA who's done due diligence on a regular basis and understands the special circumstances that due diligence brings up and how to look beyond just these little boxes that CPAs tend to kind of stare into.
Mm-hmm.
Same exact thing with the lawyer. The lawyer is not there just to paper the deal. The lawyer is there, particularly if he's a good M&A lawyer. Not only does that person understand what to look for in, let's say, all the contracts that the company has that he's going to or she's going to review, but they also understand the business implications of those contracts. And so you can get a great corporate finance attorney who's taken 10 companies public but's never done an M&A deal. That's not the right guy or gal. Right. You want someone who's an M&A specialist. And finally, you want, I'm going to call it a financial professional. Not necessarily an investment banker, but somebody who's an M&A specialist. That's really critical. And I would say be very cautious. There are a number of folks out there, and I'm always cautious when I talk about this area. For smaller companies, the folks who tend to service them are what's called business brokers. And there are some good business brokers out there. But business brokers are licensed under the real estate section of California, not under corporations. In other words, they're not investment bankers. And so not all, but many of these folks come in from real estate with the idea that they're going to make a bigger percentage selling companies than they are real estate. They think it's a more lucrative area, so they go into it. Well, they may know how to sell. They may know how to do an introduction. But unless they have a strong business background, I'd be very cautious, or at least beef up my team with an attorney and a CPA, because a lot of the times, again, not always, there's some good ones out there, but oftentimes, these folks don't understand the difference between a balance sheet and a profit and loss statement,
right,
and how the two coincide together. That's a big problem. So you really want to make sure that your team has really a financial professional, an accountant, and a lawyer, and that all of them have M&A experience.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of moving parts when you're looking at a transaction like this. And unless somebody understands at least a large segment of not only the moving parts, but how they integrate with each other, you'll overlook stuff. You won't see stuff. So it's always good to call in an expert to be able to help you.
People forget that there's an expense beyond the acquisition cost. Or really, it is the acquisition cost. But beyond the value of the company that you're buying, whatever money you're going to have to put up for that, there's a real expense to the acquisition itself, i.e. the professionals, the time that your own management team is going to have to put in. So be ready to spend another $100,000 for an average-sized deal minimum. By the way, by average-sized deal, I'm talking a deal of somewhere between $5 and $50 million. At least $100,000 is going to go into that acquisition cost, and the majority of it's going to go into due diligence.
Now, you know, the other thing that that people should keep in mind is that if one of the parties in this transaction is a public company, it changes the playing field considerably about what you're able to do in order to, before you can start to announce that you're interested in doing this. Because there's this basic rule that says if a public company is involved and there's a decision made that could affect the stock price positively or negatively, you've got 24 hours to get the information out. So the M&A transaction that I talked about with Lucent, I was not involved in it. It ended up that there was just someone from product marketing, someone from engineering, and an M&A attorney. That those three people from Lucent ended up talking to their counterparts at this other company, and they had to go behind the scenes because you couldn't get anybody, you couldn't let anybody think that there was something going on. And it was funny, when they announced it, I happened to be in California, but I wasn't talking to that company. I was down talking to Qualcomm about something else. Everybody thought that I was involved in it because it was in my area. But it's just another one of those things that could just change the direction. And, you know, if you're going to be in that position, you need very qualified people in each of those three positions to be able to talk about it. Well, it ends up that we got about 15 seconds left. So we ended up talking a lot about mergers and acquisitions today. We're probably going to talk about this a little bit more in the future. But, Mark, I appreciate it, and hopefully everybody will enjoy it, and look forward to talking in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on again, Jim.
You take care.
You too.
Once again, you've been listening to the Private Investing and Business Hour, brought to you by CalCap Partners and OC Talk Radio, Orange County's only community radio station.